Well, take your Bibles this morning, if you would, please. And we're going to be in Hebrews chapter 11. Hopefully, we'll be able to finish this chapter. I actually planned to do it last week, and I didn't, and resisted the urge to add more to my notes. That's kind of what I end up doing when I end up having too much. I feel like I'm not going to have enough the next week, and then I add more, and then it's too much again. So I just left it alone. But we're going to be in Hebrews 11. We're going to finish our message today. I gave you the same handout as last week. I just filled in the blanks from the week that we did, and we will do the last 3 points. We have been walking through this book over the course of the last, several months now, and we have been learning a very simple truth that Jesus is better. And he is better not than just everything else in our life, but specifically everything that they were used to in the Old Testament system, the people, and also the ceremonial practices as well. And so this book gets very deep, partly because he deals with deep concepts, and partly because some of these concepts are unfamiliar to us. They're not part of our normal life. And so in the last few chapters, he even tells us, even writing to Jewish people, he tells the audience that this is going to be a meatier section of God's word, and some of us are not ready to hear it. And so in this chapter, he talks about how Jesus is a better high priest in chapter 7, and how he is our better way to God because he's an eternal high priest. He's an unchangeable high priest. He's a perfect high priest. He talks about how Jesus gives us a better covenant, and that it's not like the old covenant where we were responsible to uphold our end of the bargain and always fall short and always be failures. This is where God would change our very hearts. In chapter 9, he talks about being a better tabernacle, God dwelling with us in a new way. In chapter 10, he talks about him being a better sacrifice. And all of these things culminate while he tells us that if we reject these things, if we say we don't need these things, we're basically saying to God that his blood, his sacrifice, his life is not a special thing. It's an unholy thing, and we regard it as unimportant. And then we're stuck to try to find all of the things that Jesus provides in the world, and we're not going to find it because we cannot find what Jesus gives in the place where Jesus is not. Now, he gets to chapter 11, and he says that this is supposed to elicit a response in our life. Just like every other truth in the New Testament, God gives us a truth, he tells us about who we are in Christ, and then he tells us what we should do with this truth, how we should respond to this truth. And that's what Hebrews 11 begins to talk about. And he talks about how we should have faith. And 2 weeks ago, we defined what faith was. I said that we usually say that faith is trust, which is true, and that it's usually blind. It's assenting to something for no reason at all. And that's not what faith means. That's not what the word means. That's not how the Bible uses the word. Faith is trust in action. That's what the word means. It's a response in my life based upon the trust that I have. The trust is not just a mental state, it's a life state. And that's why the word began to be used in the book of Acts as an entire way of life. They kept the faith, or they left the faith. And he tells us that we should have faith in our life. And he begins to define what faith does by using a lot of Old Testament examples. He defends the claim that faith is trust in all the truths that we know, in action in our life, by reminding them of stories that the Jewish people would have been very familiar with. And so if faith is trust in action, what are some things that faith would do? Well, last week, that's where we started, and I gave you number one. Faith is not primarily blind. It doesn't automatically insinuate ignorance. However, if I do trust God, I will trust God concerning things that I don't understand because I do know him. And so number one, I said active faith will trust that God means what he says concerning unfamiliar things. We talked about Noah, how he was told to build an ark, even though it concerned things not seen as yet. He knew God. He knew exactly what God wanted him to do. He knew exactly what God was warning him would happen. He had just not experienced those things in his life. But because he trusted God more than his own senses, because he knew what God wanted, he trusted that this is what he should do. And so he responded by building an ark. Concerning unfamiliar things, then he moves on to a very prominent character, Abraham. And he talks about him for a little while. We talked about how active faith will trust that God means what he said concerning seemingly impossible things. And Sarah and Abraham were told they would have a child, even though they were old. And so it says that by faith, Sarah received strength to have a child. She tried to get pregnant at 90. She took care of her pregnancy, assuming she wouldn't have a miscarriage, even though she was 90 years old. She went through the process as if she was 20 years old, just because she assumed that God meant what he said, even though that seemed to be impossible. Later on, we see in Abraham's life that he responds as well about seemingly impossible things. God told him to offer up Isaac. He knew Isaac was going to be the one to have all of his promises come through in his life. And he also knew God told him to sacrifice Isaac. Somehow he was going to still have life, even though he was going to give that life. He doesn't know how those two things are going to work out. They seem to not work together. But he trusts that God means what he says, and so he acted in response by obeying, trusting that God would, raise him from the dead. Something like that would have had to happen, and that's exactly what it says. So even that things seem impossible in our life, and sometimes God commands us to do things that seem like they won't work out. God tells us to give if we want to receive, tells us to lose our life if we want to find it. And we know what God tells us to do, we know what God promises will happen, they just don't seem to mesh. How much we trust God is going to dictate whether or not we respond in faith. Seemingly impossible things. Then we talked about our future hope. All of these things, these actions that Abraham took, and then, of course, Isaac blessing his sons, Jacob blessing his sons, Joseph giving commandment concerning his bones for his future, were all based upon the idea that what God had promised about their future nation would happen. That even though they were living as strangers in a land, living in tents that were it was overrun by nations of other people, God promised him that his people would have this land. And so he made decisions based on that future hope. Joseph made decisions based on that future hope, even though it seemed that that hope was more obscure. They weren't even living in that land anymore. They were living in a different land, and everything was fine. And what he tells us is that if we trust that God means what he says, even concerning our future that we cannot see yet, but we know that God promises, we will make real-life decisions now because we believe that God is going to fulfill his promises for later that we cannot see. And so our faith will dictate what decisions we actually make. So we talked about the active faith trusts that God means what he says. And so now we're going to go to number two. We're going to move on to another prominent character. And we're going to move on to Moses. Of course, he's talking to Jewish people. So he's going to spend time with Moses for a while because he's going to be easy to interact with. And number two, active faith trusts that God is better. That God is better. Better than what? So we talked about the patriarchs and their hope and belief that God means what he says, whether or not it was right in front of them. Even though they couldn't see what he was promising, his word was right in front of them, so they knew exactly what to do. But he moves on to Moses. And he spends a long time talking about him. It's an easy example. But before he talks about Moses' decisions, he starts Moses' story. And active faith trusts that God is better. Letter A, he's better than dire circumstances. He's better than dire circumstances. God is not bound by the difficult circumstances we find ourselves in. Now, this very short story, I think, is quite interesting. So everybody look at verse 23, Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to begin the story of Moses, not with Moses, but with Moses' parents. Because Moses' story begins in quite an interesting place. So let's read verse 23, and then we'll talk about this for a second. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Okay, the king's commandment, what was happening? At this time in history, Pharaoh had arisen long before that didn't know Joseph. Joseph and all of his family had moved in. They began to multiply. They weren't friends anymore, and the Pharaoh of Egypt is scared. He's scared because they're multiplying really, really fast underneath the umbrella of Egypt as their friends, and he's afraid that they will make a new nation inside of their nation and revolt and take over their nation. So the only way that he can do that, to prevent that, is to keep them under his thumb. So he makes them slaves. But they're multiplying a lot. And so he's afraid that regardless of the fact that they're not having an equal authority or even a good relationship anymore, wouldn't change the fact that they still have a lot of manpower. So he makes a decree that every child, if he's a boy, should be thrown into the river, at least to decrease the male population so a future generation of soldiers can't arise out of all of this. Then it says that by faith, Moses' parents hid him, seeing he was a proper child. So the question then becomes, what did by faith they trusted? So faith is to trust God and then to respond. So the question is, what is it that they trusted? Did they trust that God was going to save their child? Why would they assume that? God didn't save the child of their neighbors or other people down the road. Are they trusting that their child is for some unknown reason more valuable? I mean, Moses was just born. We have no idea what he's going to do. There's no indication in the Bible that they were giving any special promise that God was going to save their baby and not everybody else's. So what was their faith response? See, when we put ourselves in their shoes, suddenly we have to ask ourselves this question. Did they, for no reason at all, trust that God was going to help them in their difficult situation, even though they hadn't helped their neighbor in their difficult situation? But what did they do? They put Moses in an ark. They made a little boat for him, and they put him in it, and they sent him down the river. Why? Because what they did trust was that God was not bound by the circumstances that they were in, and that God could use something as ridiculous as putting your baby inside of a little homemade boat and sending him down the river and use it for good. He could take care of his baby if they wanted to, in spite of the fact that it seemed like there was no hope. And so what they had faith in was not that for sure God was going to help us, even though he hadn't helped somebody else, but what they had faith in was that God could. And so they responded. Let me give you an illustration or an example. Suppose you have cancer. Okay. And it's bad. Stage 4. You're supposed to have faith, right? You are. But what are you supposed to have faith in? That God is going to heal you? I mean, are we saying that every person who has not gotten healed from cancer, they've not gone into remission, they died from having cancer, are we saying that every single one of those was a bad person, they didn't have enough faith? Does the Bible promise us anywhere if you're a good Christian and you trust God enough, you won't get sick? Does it promise that anywhere? Does it promise the opposite of that? Yeah, almost. And then we have examples. Paul asked the Lord specifically, take this away. And God said, no. So if we're supposed to have faith, but God doesn't promise us that my dire circumstances are going to be changed in the way that I want them to be, what is my faith in? My faith is in that God is above the circumstances. And so I do not lose hope. And I trust that God is right in the decision that he makes. And I respond accordingly. Well, what does that mean? That regardless of how hopeless it seems, I still obey the doctor's orders instead of go home in despair, thinking that all hope is lost. In spite of how hopeless it seems, I still ask God for help, knowing that he can just as easily help me in this circumstance than in another. If Moses' parents didn't practice faith in God, even though they had no promise that Moses would be saved, they wouldn't have bothered to put him in the ark and send him down the river. Because what's going to happen? Well, he's just going to die anyway. So they responded in faith, not with promises that God was going to meet their dire circumstances in a positive way, but in trust that God was above them. And see, the thing is, most of us think that faith in God during difficult circumstances is nothing more than trusting that God is going to take them all away. And since we know that that's not true, some of us practice no faith when we have difficult circumstances, and we try to deal with them on our own, as if God is bound by them, that God is not able to do anything above it. Faith trusts that God is better than whatever it is that I'm dealing with. Most of us trust God only in that way so we can handle our difficulty without him, or in despair we do nothing. But faith trusts that God is above them. Letter B, faith trusts that God is better than the pleasures of the world. Most of what Moses' story is about here at the beginning is how he did grow up in Egypt. So a situation would be better, right? He had better education, he had more money, he had more prestige. He was raised by Pharaoh's daughter. He was probably very quickly found out that he was a Hebrew, but my daughter likes him, so whatever. He's going to raise him in our household. He's not going to be a Hebrew. And so he gets raised in the household of Pharaoh, having seemingly anything that he wanted. He gets to look out and see the people of God, so to speak, being persecuted, being enslaved, not actually having a good life. So why would he want to give up his good life for the life of these people of God? It doesn't seem like it's working out very well for them. But by faith, what that meant is that Moses trusted that God was better, and so he responded. How? Verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So he grows up in the palace of the richest and most powerful nation in the world at that time. There's nothing in the people of God that appeals in an earthly sense. But Moses trusted that God was better than that. So he said, I don't want to be the son of Pharaoh's daughter. I don't want to be identified with the world. But why did he do that? Why would he make that decision? It says that he saw the reproach of Christ as greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. The Egyptians had more riches than the Israelites had. That's for sure. They had more money. They had more power. They had more earthly treasure than the Israelites did. But what he saw was that even though the people were living in reproach, he saw being a member of the people of God as a greater reward. He had respect unto the recompense of the reward. And so what did that mean in his life? It meant that he left the world to become a part of the people of God, even though being a member of the people of God meant that he seemingly was knocked down a few rungs in the eyes of the prestige of the world. And many Christians are still struggling with that in their own life. We're supposed to live by faith, but what we see is that the rewards of this world are greater than the rewards of being a Christian. What we see is that the money that the world has is definitely more valuable than the reward of being a follower of Christ. We see earthly treasure as more valuable than eternal treasure. We live for now. We want to identify with the world. We want people to see us attached to the people and the corporations and the situations that people respect. We want to be attached to it. We want our name to be on the pamphlet. We want to be on the brochure. We want to have our name attached to the treasures of Egypt. We want to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. But by faith, trusting God recognizes that he's better than these things. And so the life decisions I make of where my direction is, where I'm headed, what goals I'm trying to reach, are going to dictate what steps I make in the next few years. Our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip, just give them to them so we know who all's here this morning. We'd appreciate that. We'd appreciate that. So what are your goals? Some of you grew up in a life of more money, and some of you didn't. And some of us are searching for whatever the world sees as valuable, and some of us are not. By faith, we trust that God is better. Ultimately, serving God is not a life of sacrifice. It's a life of self-denial, but God promises that if we lose our life, we find it. Ultimately, serving Christ is the best thing we can do out of self-interest, because it's always better for us. We just have to recognize that he's better than the things that we normally attach to self-interest. Because life and eternity are much better for the followers of God, the reproaches of Christ are greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. But do we really believe that? Or are we seeking to be the prince of this world? If so, we don't have faith that God is better than the world. Active faith trusts that God is better. Number three, active faith follows. It follows. Now, some of these overlap, but at the end of the day, it's important to recognize that this is not an exhaustive list either. And I'll get to that in a second. But he's going to talk about a lot of steps and decisions that they made after this. So Moses trusted that God was better than Egypt, that being a member of the people of God was better than the treasures of Egypt. Being associated with God was better than being associated with Egypt. And so he left all the prestige of Egypt and became one of the peasants. Then when God let them out, they were asked to do a lot of things that didn't make a whole lot of sense. And that's letter A. It follows into peculiar practice. Peculiar practice. Sometimes God's going to ask us to do things that are odd. For example, God starts to bring plagues on the people of Egypt. So those were easy to watch in some sense because a lot of things were happening in Egypt and they weren't happening where the Israelites were. God was bringing on hail, but not in the land where the Israelites were, in Goshen. God was bringing darkness. God was bringing locusts. God was bringing flies. God was bringing lice. God was bringing frogs. But the people of Israel were fine. And then we get to the 10th plague, the one that's really supposed to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. God promises that an angel will come through and will kill every firstborn of every family. But then he warns the Israelites that that's going to be true for your families as well, unless you do this. Now, mind you, they had no feasts up until this time. Israel didn't practice the Feast of the Passover or Pentecost or Tabernacles or Trumpets or any of the things that we associate with them. That was after this. They didn't do this on a regular basis. And so this is brand new. And so God tells them at the 10th plague that this is what they need to do. It's verse 28. Through faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. Tonight, the angel of the Lord will come through Egypt, okay? And he's going to kill every firstborn of every family. Wow, okay. Unless, all right, you go out into your field, okay, and you take a sheep, all right, and you kill it, a one-year-old sheep without any blemishes on it, okay? And you take its blood, all right, and you wipe it on your door frame, on your front door. Okay. Now take the lamb and make it dinner. And I want you to wear your shoes and carry your staff, and I want you to eat dinner inside with the blood wiped on your front door. That's what I want you to do. There's very few things as odd as that. Imagine if that was your instructions today. Take one of your lambs, wipe its blood on your front door, you'll be all right. Eat it and make sure you're wearing your shoes, carry your staff, be ready to walk out very soon. That's what I want you to do today. And so by faith, they did. Odd things that God had asked them to do. And the fact is, we know in the years in the future, they're going to leave Egypt, right? They're going to get to Mount Sinai. God's going to give them the law. And the law is going to contain a lot of things that don't make sense. Mundane things. Things that seem completely random and almost nitpicky. Like when you have a particular disease, you have to make sure you wash with running water? What? Now, that wasn't a thing back then. You have to bury your waste. You can't just leave it in the desert. What? You can't eat these animals, but you can eat these? Now, many of the laws that we know, actually looking back in 21st century medical knowledge, a lot of the laws of Moses actually make a lot of hygienic sense that they weren't aware of. But some of them still didn't make any sense. Like, you're not allowed to mix your cloths. You're not allowed to mix your seeds. A lot of random stuff. And so the thing is, what he wanted them to do, and there's a longer conversation about this, but he wanted them to recognize that I know better than you do, and so just do what I say, and you'll be all right. And here, he starts with something as odd as wipe the blood on your front door, and you'll be all right. And so faith, which trusts that God is better, that trusts that God means what he says, it follows. It does what God says, regardless if I can fully wrap my mind around why. I know exactly what it is, and so I do it because I know that he told me to. Peculiar practice. What about some other things he told them to do? Look at verse 29. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians essayed to do and were drowned. Remember, I don't need to retell this story. When they were leaving Egypt, they go up into the sea. He tells them to walk through it. That must have been nerve-wracking with walls of water on each side. Like, there's nothing holding them up, and the entire nation is going to walk through it. And they did, because God told them to. Well, look what he does, tells them to do next. Verse 30. Many years in the future, they finally get into the promised land. Verse 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were compassed about 7 days. Now, notice, by the way, it doesn't say, by faith, they felled the walls of Jericho. Because they didn't knock the walls of Jericho down. God did. By faith, they didn't defeat Jericho. God did. But by faith, what did they do? Walked around it. That was what they were told to do. So they're going to show their strength walking into this nation, trying to tell these people in the promised land that belongs to them who they really are and who their God is, and they're going to practice this strength in the very first city they come to by walking in circles around it. Like, they didn't run in and scream and yell and attack the city and then destroy them. That wasn't their initial response. The initial thing that they did was they walked around the city. Why? Because God told them to. Now, mind you, every single one of these things was very clear. They knew exactly what God was telling them to do. They knew exactly how they were supposed to keep the Passover. They knew exactly that they were supposed to cross the Red Sea. They knew exactly that they were supposed to circle Jericho. And if they actually trusted that God was who he said he was, they would follow. And the thing is, God tells us to do a lot of things in his word. And we decide whether or not to obey him as we come to every decision based upon whether or not we think it's the wisest thing to do at this moment. And that decision is based upon our knowledge of what has worked for us, what hasn't worked in the past or what I saw in somebody else's life. And he gives us these extreme examples because the fact is none of these things would have been what they picked. Walking around cities doesn't usually defeat cities. You don't usually escape people by walking through a river. Nobody defeats death wiping blood on their front door. But all those things are what God told us to do. And God tells us to do things in our life that don't make sense to us all the time. If we trust him, then we follow. Into peculiar practice, letter B, trusting God follows into God's people. Into God's people. He gives an example in Jericho, while we're talking about Jericho, of Rahab. Verse 31, by faith, Rahab, the harlot, perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. Speaking of Jericho, there was a harlot, there was a prostitute in Jericho. She saw the people coming in as spies earlier, was they were kind of looking at what Jericho was going to be before they knew how they were going to defeat him, before God gave them the instructions. And Rahab had a choice to make. She grew up in Jericho. She was used to Jericho. She had friends in Jericho. She had family in Jericho. This is her life. But she knew about God. She had seen what God had done to them in the wilderness, taking them out of Egypt. She had heard the stories of who God was. And so she had a decision to make. Do I help God's people or do I help my people? But she decided to be part of God's people, even though she wasn't one of God's people yet. And so she followed into where God was, even though that's not where she was. And there's a lot of people who have to make that decision, not only for salvation, but in their everyday life. Because some of us grew up in families that were not part of God's people. And so we're used to the world. We're used to Jericho. We grew up in Jericho. We have neighbors in Jericho. We have family in Jericho. That's just who we are. And so many of us want to stay there because that's where we're comfortable. But faith follows knowing that God's people is better than the people of Egypt, the people of Jericho, the people of the world. And this story repeats itself throughout the Bible, whether it's Moses leaving Egypt, Rahab leaving Jericho, Ruth leaving Moab, David's mighty men leaving Philistia. Every one of these people had to make this decision. Do I leave the world and become a part of God's people, or do I stay in the world because that's where I'm from? Faith actually makes the active decision to be part of God's people. Now we'll get to the last couple. Faith follows. And letter C, sometimes it follows into victory. Into victory. Now, the point of this chapter, as I said a moment ago, was not to provide an exhaustive list of the things that faith does. It was just to defend the claim that faith does. Faith doesn't think, faith acts. And so talking to Hebrew people, he brings up Hebrew stories. So, well, you know Abel, you know Enoch, you know Noah, you know Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, you know Moses. And of course, the stories there and going into the promised land. And so he finishes off because he could go on for a really long time. We haven't progressed that long in Israelite history yet, have we? So he says in verse 32, and what shall I more say? The time would fail me to tell of Gideon, of Barak, and of Samson, of Jephthah. And those are just judges. Of David also, Samuel, of the prophets. I mean, he could tell stories about Ezra and Zerubbabel coming back to Israel and their story of leaving Babylon and coming back to the promised land. He could have told stories about Daniel, for goodness sake, and how he stopped the mouths of lions, and he'll allude to that in a minute. He could have told stories about many of the kings, like Jehoshaphat, walking into battle with his choir in the front because he wanted to praise God, knowing he couldn't win when he got there. So many stories he could have told, but the point was not to exhaust every decision that we will make because many of these specifics we're not going to have in our life. God's probably not going to come to you and tell you to murder your son and see whether or not you trust that all his promises are going to be true. God's probably not going to tell you to cross a river and it's going to, you know, part for you. God's probably not going to tell you to walk around a city so that you can defeat it and take it over. But we make those types of decisions in our life. And so he's given enough examples for the time being. He says, but what he finishes here is very interesting. Look, verse 33. He could continue to talk, he says. He says, verse 33, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. That's his Daniel reference. Quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, women received their dead raised to life again. And he talks about all these things that God can do. God is not bound by the way the situation looks. Just because it looks like there is no hope doesn't mean that there is. Just because it looks like I'm not strong enough doesn't mean that he isn't. Just because it looks like I don't have the answer doesn't mean that he shouldn't be obeyed because I don't understand him. And in response to that, God can overcome difficult situations. God can heal you when you are sick. God can bring peace in your family when it seems like he can't. God can overcome. God can give victory. God can do those things that we want him to do. The Bible says in 1 John 5, whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world. And this is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith. It is not us that overcomes the world. It's God that overcomes the world because he has overcome the world, he says in John 15. And our trust in him in response can actually initiate what God can do in our life. And we can see those victorious things. And so we want to follow God into victory. It has to come through him. And it only comes through him if we trust him enough to obey him. However, letter D, faith follows God even into suffering. Into suffering. Now notice what he does in this second half. By faith, they subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, quenched the violence of fire, stopped the mouths of lions. All these miraculous things and victorious things and positive things. By faith, God's power was enacted in their life, and they saw it. And it was in a positive way. Women received their dead raised to life again, verse 35. And others, verse 35, were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had trial of cruel mockings, scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. What a contrast. Now, when you're reading through Hebrews 11, you tend to read all the way through that section as if it's just a random list of things that have happened. But you see the two sides? Wrought righteousness and quenched the violence of fire and were tortured, were tormented, they wandered. Because as you have your story of Daniel being elevated, you also had the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego right next to them being thrown into a fiery furnace. Now, they were released, but others weren't. As you have the stories of the prophets who did miracles, you have the story of Isaiah, who tradition says was sawn asunder. As you have some of the prophets coming back and being respected by lots of people, you have Elijah and Elisha, who are being chased by the king half the time, having to be fed by birds and by a creek because they're being chased by the king and the queen. wandering in the desert. For every story of victory, you have a Jeremiah who was like the only one in the entire country doing right besides his scribe and a couple close friends, who's thrown into prison for preaching the truth, even when it was obvious that it was the truth, even when the king himself came to him and said, "What does God say next?" Because it was so obvious he was right, and throws him back into prison. For each one of these, the conclusion was not, how do I think this is going to turn out for my good in present circumstances? Because sometimes it did, and sometimes it didn't. Circumstances shouldn't dictate the decisions that we make in life. Neither should our anticipated circumstances that are temporary. Most of us make decisions based on a utilitarian mindset. How do I think this will turn out for me? And a lot of times, that utilitarian mindset is so short-sighted that if we feel like it's going to make us uncomfortable, put us in a bad position, then we choose not to follow. And so sometimes, he says, following takes us to a place that is great, where kingdoms are subdued and nations are given over and victory is had and enemies defeated and God's power made known in a very obvious way on your behalf. And sometimes it doesn't work out the way that you thought. I mean, we read the story of Jeremiah. He's ignored most of his life. The very last thing he tells them to do is, "Hey guys, it's finally over. Just stay put." And that's what they don't do. And they pack up and go to Egypt and they take him with them. And that was his life. Most of his life, people ignored him, they persecuted him, they laughed at him, they made fun of him. Most of his life he did. But by faith, he followed God, even though the circumstances in his life that were temporary weren't always ideal. And many of us, that's what we're afraid of, and so we don't follow. He tells us, all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. But trust and obedience is not always that we know that the peripheral and temporary outcome would be good on our behalf. Because that's not the point. Our circumstances should not be driving our decisions, and our anticipated circumstances should not be driving it either. Faith follows wherever God leads, wherever that might be. Now, we come to the end, number four, and we'll be done. If active faith were practiced by those who never knew Jesus, how much more should it be seen in us? So let us return to the book of Hebrews for a moment. We've been in Hebrews, I know, but let's return to the book, because Hebrews 11 gets ripped out of Hebrews and preached all by itself, because it's fun, because you don't have to study to preach Hebrews 11, because it tells you all the stories you already know. That's the point of Hebrews chapter 11. They're not supposed to learn all these things. They already know all these things. And so Hebrews 11 is so easy to preach from. And therefore, it gets torn away from what he's been talking about. And what has he been talking about? He's been talking about how Jesus is better. How everything in the Old Testament, the systems, the laws, the priests, the covenants, the sacrifices, all of them pointed to Christ. And then he says that should elicit a response in our life. And then he goes back to the Old Testament and he gives you a bunch of stories from this time period of people who are completely unaware of basically everything that's been taught in Hebrews. They don't know that Jesus is a better high priest. They don't know that Jesus gives a better covenant. They don't know that Jesus is a better sacrifice. They don't know that Jesus is a better tabernacle. Abraham didn't know that. Moses didn't know that. So none of the examples he just gave are aware of anything that we've learned in the book of Hebrews. So why are they examples in the book of Hebrews? Because he's giving you a specific kind of argument that's used in the Bible several times. One time Jesus made this type of argument. He said, if your child asks an egg from you in the morning, would you give him a scorpion? No. If he asked you for bread, would you give him a stone? No. And this is what he says. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more should your heavenly Father know how to give good gifts to those who ask of him? It's called an a fortiori argument. Simply means this. If it's true in a lesser sense, obviously it's true in a greater sense. If your parents know how to take care of their kids and you're evil and you're weak and you're you have your own problems, then obviously God knows how to take care of you. That's the type of argument. This is what he does in Hebrews. If the people in the Old Testament who don't know Jesus, who didn't know that he was going to be a greater high priest, who have no idea where the law was pointing to, who have all the veils, who have all the shadows, who Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, they didn't have a Bible. There was none of the decisions they made. There was no precedent for them. They had no prior example of people being raised to life. They had no prior example of God doing miracles. They had none of that. And these are the decisions they made in their life. Why does he put Hebrews 11 right here? Because if it was true for Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and Moses, and Rahab, of all people, and you know everything you know about who Jesus is, you get to have all of this. You get to not only know everything that God did, but have an explanation as to why it was there. How much more should active faith be present in your life? This is how he finishes. These all, verse 39, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. So what does he say here? If it was true for them, my goodness, it should be true for us. But somehow we give ourselves a pass because we're not Bible characters. But the exact thing that he says is, if anyone should have not practiced faith, it was them. And if anyone should, it should be us. And so he's going to apply that to you now in Hebrews 12. Seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside the weight and the sin that does so easily beset us, and let us run the race that's set before us. But we'll get to that next week as we move on. Faith follows. It did for them. It should for us. Let's see. We'll continue on next week.